Hi, everybody. Can you hear me? It's so good to be here. So thank you so much. And it's interesting to come into a retreat midway through. You can tell a lot from about a retreat when you come in midway through. And I have to tell you, I've been really touched by just the felt sense, the visceral sense of this retreat already. There's a real stability of practice already. You can see it. It feels like it's being held. It feels walking around the grounds and here that the retreat is really held. And I'm just really feeling a sense of sweetness and kindness and genuine, good-hearted motivation for the process that I'm just really appreciating. So thank you for that, and thank you for tolerating my coming in the middle of it. It can sometimes be disruptive. So my name is Susan Kaiser Greenland. I think it's helpful. Some of you may know me, but for those of you who don't, sometimes it's helpful to hear a little bit about somebody's background before they start talking. I joke that I'm a recovering lawyer. Sometimes it's not so much of a joke. I started practicing meditation in 1993 when I was pregnant with my 18-year-old son, and my husband was diagnosed with stage 4 lymphoma. And he took me to a Zen center to learn meditation because I was driving him crazy. He said, "You have to manage your stress." And that's how I started. And the Zen thing didn't work out too well for me. I couldn't tolerate it. I had way too much going on inside of me, and I simply couldn't tolerate sitting still. I was working at a corporation, at a television network at the time in the city, and I had a 3-year-old. But I started listening to tapes. The Path with Heart had come out about that time by the guy who actually founded the center, Jack Kornfeld. And those tapes I listened to night after night after night. And later I listened to tapes by Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg. And those got me through a very, very difficult time. When we got through that time, my husband, by the way, is just fine. He's in remission and has been for a long time. My son is 18, going to college in the fall, and my daughter's 21 in her last year of college, so my husband and I are looking at empty nesting next year. And we all moved to California in 1998, I'm not sure if that was right. And then I started studying with Ken MacLeod. Ken MacLeod is a Western teacher. He's American. He was trained in the Tibetan tradition. I studied with him and some of his teachers for many years. Around that time, in 1998, I started working with my own son. I had seen how meditation had helped me, and I started working with him a little bit to see whether I could modify these practices, primarily at that time attention practices, to see whether they could help him focus a little bit more and self-regulate a little bit more. He had problems more in the physical regulation department. He always had a wonderful, sunny disposition. But he did have self-management problems and attention problems, and I wanted to see if this would help. By 2000, my husband and I started a foundation called the Inner Kids Foundation, and we started taking these practices into schools, and we had some other people who helped us. What you'll see as you follow the course of mindfulness and kids in my mind, and maybe mindfulness in general, is many of us started building. And then as our own practices developed, we then started dismantling. So there's an effort. So in early careers, you often see an effort toward building foundations and this sort of thing. And then as age comes and time comes, you see those dismantle a little bit, yet the practice stay and the training and the other things happen. But the infrastructure slows down. And that's what happened to me. And we recently closed down the Inner Kids Foundation, which was then the Mindfulness Together Foundation, and there are other wonderful, wonderful foundations in place who are doing huge work and great work around the country and, frankly, around the world. So that's my background. My spiritual practice is an interesting one in that my father was Catholic, my mother was Presbyterian, I married a Jew, my kids were bar and bat mitzvahed, and I am heavy into Buddhist practice. So I have sort of a tossed salad background, and I know firsthand how sometimes these religious differences can actually pull people apart rather than pull them together. I'm committed in my work to bringing secular mindfulness into the public sector. I'm also committed in my work that the secular mindfulness that I bring into the public sector is consistent with the Buddhist practice. I do not see this as a contradiction. And we're going to talk more about that today in the subject of this talk, which is really, Diana had asked me to talk about kind of the state of mindfulness right now. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to tell you my background, just so you know, while this is only my opinion, I'm hardly, you know, like the grand poobah of mindfulness in the United States for children. But it is the opinion of somebody who's been in it from the beginning. So I wanted you to hear that. And I will tell you, Richard and I were talking about this at dinner, that one of our first conversations when he and his wife and his colleagues were starting mindful schools was over this idea of the B word, Buddhism, and whether in how appropriate it was to use it, how careful we had to be. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in this talk tonight, about how my thinking has changed on that based on the changes in the field. Now, unfortunately, I wasn't here the first night, so if you can just humor me a minute, and can I get a sense of who's in the room? How many people here are public school teachers? If you could raise your hand. Great. How many people are private school teachers? Great. How many people are public school administrators? Private school administrators. How many people focus on early childhood? How many people focus on elementary, middle, high school, college? How many people focus on a secular setting? And how many people focus in a Buddhist setting? And how many people, is there overlap for that? Great. All right, thank you. That helps me with how I'm going to talk a little bit. Also, please, I need these glasses now, so you'll see me be doing a lot of this. Okay, so mindfulness, what I've seen and what I'm thinking about for the future. Let me tell you that in the last 12 years, if anyone had told me that there would be such a widespread movement to bring mindfulness into the school, I would have told them that they were crazy. You know, this recovery lawyer thing has some benefits and some, you know, not such great benefits. And one of them is I'm quite skeptical and I'm quite pragmatic. And I never thought we would have this much movement to bring mindfulness into schools because of the Buddhist component. And I thought that there would be tremendous pushback. I'm not convinced that down the line there won't be. But we don't have it now. It's really quite wonderful. So what have we done in the last 12 years? Really briefly, what we've done is mindfulness has become popular. It's kind of trendy, huh? And this has got a lot of wonderful qualities. This is a really good thing for all of us. It's a good thing that mindfulness is becoming part of the zeitgeist. It also has some downsides, and we're going to talk a little bit about those later. What we really have done in the last 12 years is many, many people around the globe have taken classical adult practices, practices that were attended for adults, and translated them and adapted them in an age-appropriate, a developmentally appropriate way for children as young as four. This is huge. This is a huge difference from where we were 12 years ago. We have a well-known, well-accepted, well-tried body of practices now from which to work. Unfortunately, they aren't yet well-researched. We're getting some research. The research is beginning, but we can't really say that these practices have been well-researched. But we can say that they've been researched in the School of Hard Knocks, and we're seeing tremendous results. So one of the things that has happened with the popularization of mindfulness is that the word mindfulness has a lot of meanings now. And a lot of people are talking about what mindfulness is and what mindfulness isn't. And that's not going to be the topic of my conversation tonight. But I do want to raise that as one of the things that we're going to be looking at in the next 12 years is we're going to have to start paying some attention to what is it that we're calling mindfulness. This afternoon, in listening to Diana, one of the things that struck me over and over again, it didn't surprise me because I've known Diana for a long time and she is very well trained in the classical tradition, was the number of times she used the word remember. the number of times she used the word remind myself, remind yourself. So when Diana talks about mindfulness as a tool, about mindfulness as an investigation, one of the qualities of that tool is to remind yourself of any one of a number of things. And we'll talk a little bit more about what those things are in a second. Now, this makes a lot of sense because if you take the word mindfulness and you look at the translation from the original language in which it was written, one of the translations, is the literal translation, is to remember or to take heed or to remember. So for the purposes of this talk, and as I said, to remember is not a complete definition of mindfulness. It's also not an operational definition of mindfulness. But for the purposes of this talk, if we can think of to remember when we think of mindfulness, that's where I'm coming from in a lot of what I'm talking about tonight. So what I would like to talk about tonight, since we know where we are, oh, I have one last question. How many of you are brand new to practicing mindfulness with children? That's very exciting. Welcome. And that's fantastic. How many of you are currently practicing mindfulness or teaching mindfulness to children? That's great. That's great. And I saw some people didn't raise their hands. So how does that work? So can anybody kind of popcorn up what that means? If you're counseling. So if you're counseling, are you bringing mindfulness into your counseling practice? Okay, so I would, okay, great. How many of you are counselors bringing mindfulness into your counseling practice? Ah, so that's it. So we have a number of counselors here. Thank you. Okay, great. This is an important distinction, and this is an important thing to remember when we talk about training teachers. And again, we're going to get into that into more detail later. So what I'd like to talk about, because Diana asked me to talk about kind of the state of mindfulness, what I would like to talk in education right now, what I would like to talk about, since we know where we are, we know what's happened in the last 12 years, we know what we need, what I'd like to talk about is what I see as the edge, that what we need to do in the next 12 years. We know what we've done in 12 years. Now what do we need to do in the next 12 years? And I really can, in my own mind, and again, this is one person's opinion, in my own mind, I think we can really narrow that down to three things. And they all fall under the general category of really clarifying and refining what is it that mindfulness offers? What's the added value for mindfulness that none of the other wonderful programs in schools are offering? What is the mindfulness added value? I think that that is going to be a very, very important question that we look at over the next 12 years. Because one of the things we're seeing, and I'm excited about this, one of the things we're seeing is mindfulness under a very broad umbrella, which includes dance, which includes art, which includes yoga, which includes all sorts of wonderful activities that bring about some sort of contemplative experience. But when you define mindfulness that broadly, when you define art practice as mindfulness practice, it can sometimes be confusing. So for the purpose of this talk, knowing that my own personal motivation in developing mindfulness programs has been to develop mindfulness programs that are consistent with the classical tradition, I'd like to talk about what it is that mindfulness has that's unique. And we're going to talk about three different things tonight, and then we'll talk about the challenges and the opportunities in each one. The first thing that, in my humble opinion, mindfulness has to offer that is unique is a very specific methodology of attention training. A very specific methodology of attentional training that's been developed over thousands of years. The adult component of that now, I think we can say, has been pretty well researched. It's 30 years of research. So that's one. That's one thing mindfulness has that uniquely it can offer in a unique way. What's number two? In my mind, the second piece of mindfulness training that is unique is the motivation for training attention. It's the motivation for training attention. The motivation for training attention in the classical tradition is to develop a way of being in the world, a very specific way of being in the world. Now, that's different. There's a lot of great programs out there that train attention. There's a lot of great programs out there that train attention for test scores, for concentration, for working with emotional regulation. All of these very specific things, all of them are important, and there's similarities and overlap with mindfulness training. But in the classical tradition, attention is trained for the purpose of transformation. And what do we transform into? A particular way of being in the world. So in my mind, that is the second piece of mindfulness training that we have to offer. So if we're talking about being in the world in a particular way, which is the third thing that mindfulness training has to offer that is very specific and unique to mindfulness, a very specific way of being, what is that way of being? What is it that mindfulness offers that's a little bit different than what other people offer or what other disciplines offer? And it's a way of being in the world that is involved with, that is informed by remembering. Going back to that definition of mindfulness, remember to remember. The way of being in the world that mindfulness teaches is informed by remembering key universal concepts. So you'll read articles about whether or not secular mindfulness programs teach values. And there is some argument over that. Do secular mindfulness programs teach values? But secular programs that are based on the classical tradition, by definition, teach universal values. And those values, we remember those values. We are mindful of those values, and we'll talk specifically about what those values are. What happens when we're mindful of those values? What happens is a way of being in the world which is steady. We learn attentional techniques, remember that number one, that help us steady ourselves, ground ourselves. We learn non-reactivity or being less reactive through these attentional methods that we talked about in number one. And we learn those with the motivation to be in the world with kindness and compassion for self and other and an understanding that we're all connected. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about those three things, and we're going to break those three things down by what I see from having been out on the road an awful lot over the last 2 years as the challenges that we actually are facing right now on the road or out in the world. I've been very fortunate. Over the last couple of years, I've been asked to travel a lot, and I've traveled to different cities, I've traveled to different countries, and I've visited a lot of schools, and I've taught in a lot of schools. And I feel so, so lucky to have had that opportunity. I'm going to slow it down a bit now, but I feel very lucky to have had that opportunity. And so that's what I'd like to share with you now, is what I'm seeing out there in the field that is related to these three things that I think mindfulness uniquely offers. One of the reasons I think it's so important that we start in the next 12 years, not necessarily today, but in the next 12 years, to really identify what are the unique attributes of mindfulness is so that we don't have this two-handed approach that we see all over the place. And I was talking about key universal concepts. One of the key universal concepts that's really fundamental to mindfulness is non-dualistic thinking. So rather than either or, this, that, is it art, is it mindfulness, is it life skills, is it mindfulness, what I propose to you is if we have a less dualistic approach of at oneness or no separation, we can open our hands and it doesn't have to be an either or. So we don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, which is what I'm seeing happening with a lot of people who are calling me asking for help developing mindfulness programs. They've already got great programs that are working in place, programs that are offering tremendous value, whether they're life skills programs, whether they're all sorts of other programs that offer emotional intelligence training. So what we can do by really refining the mindfulness piece, understanding it better, developing research programs that actually research these individual pieces, is we can add these things into what people are already doing. So they don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. What they can do is take what they already have, take what they're working with, what's working for them, and enhance it with well-developed, refined mindfulness pieces. So that is the general overall thought here and why we try to go from either or to both and. So let's start Well, I did forget one thing, and I have rewritten my notes about 20 times. And this is my old law training, I will tell you. I forgot the most important word in my mind for the next 12 years. And it's a three-letter word, and it starts with the letter J, and it's joy. One of the things that this way of being in the world of mindfulness allows us to do is just plain have fun, be happy, have joy in the present moment. Grab that joy when we can. And one of the things that I'm seeing out there in the field is everybody is exhausted. It's just we're working ourselves to death, and the joy is getting sapped out of this work, and it's a joyful work with children. So let's not forget the joy. Okay, so back to the three things. We're going to start with the attention training. I'm not going to go through right now and tell you about the different types of attention training that mindfulness does, different types of attention mindfulness does train. Suffice it to say that there are three different types of attention. Mindfulness has very specific methodologies targeted toward each. But what I will tell you is that for those of us who are training teachers, which is right now what I've been doing for the last year, I've been focused more on training teachers than on training children. One of the big goals is we've got teachers who are doing a beautiful job teaching really effective, wonderful mindfulness activities. And the kids are enjoying them, the teachers are enjoying them, and they're seeing results. But if you ask them why, if you ask them, what is it you're trying to accomplish when you ring that bell? What is it you're trying to accomplish when you practice some sort of kindness? They usually don't know the answer. So one of the things that the next level of training that we all need to really focus on is really helping teachers understand these key universal concepts that are on which mindfulness is based and the different strategies that we are trying to develop through mindfulness. So that is one of the things that we really, over the next 12 years, really need to do, in my mind, is really focus now not just on the adaptation of the practices themselves, but on training trainers, the whys and the wherefores. Again, so that they can drop what they are doing, or they can drop the mindfulness practice into what they're already doing. It doesn't have to be something else. It doesn't have to be an add-on. Once we understand the key universal concepts, once we understand the strategies, then we just integrate them into what we're already doing with kids. Next, very important point about the training of attention and the training for teachers. Remember this first rule. In my mind, and this is completely my own opinion, I have no idea if anybody else agrees with me, I distinguish two different types of people that I'm training. I make a distinction between people who are already working with children and people who aren't. And I'll tell you why. One of the things we've seen in the last 12 years, and this is what makes teaching mindfulness to children a little bit more complicated than other types of teaching, period, is we really need to find facilitators who have a couple of things. One, we want facilitators with strong personal mindfulness practices. Two, we want facilitators with a strong knowledge of child development and strong group facilitation skills with children, not with adults. It's hard to find one person who has those three things. It's hard to find one person who not only has the meditation experience, but also has the child development understanding and also has group facilitation, which is different than child development understanding. Classroom teachers already have the developmental piece. They already have the group facilitation piece. School counselors have that. A lot of people in the healthcare arena have that. So those people are well equipped to teach mindfulness. The only thing is they don't have the mindfulness piece yet. So what are we going to say to those people when they come to us? Okay, so it's so great you want to teach mindfulness. Let's just wait like about 2 years. Let's all just start practicing together. We're going to practice together. And in 2 years, you can start working with kids. Now, I laugh about that, and I can say it with a lot of authority because that is something that I used to say to people when I was first starting out. I was one of these people who felt very strongly, okay, I will not teach practices to people who don't have a practice themselves. But what I have learned, deeply, deeply learned and seen over the last 2 years of being out on the road, is that there is a beautiful type of co-learning and co-teaching going on in the school environment, the likes of which I have never seen before, where teachers who are well-intentioned, well-motivated, and just want to grab any sort of mindfulness tool they can to help these children who they are serving, start practicing with the children. The children start having practice experiences that inform the teacher's practice. So there is a beautiful loop of co-teaching and co-learning going on. This is raising what I think is one of the most interesting edges for those who are training adults in mindfulness, period. Which is, if you talk, and I actually did have an interesting conversation with a group that just trains adults, but has never looked in the school setting before, just last week. And they said to me, understandably, well, this is going to be interesting because your teachers will have conceptual knowledge, because, right, we're teaching our teachers the key universal concepts we talked about. So they'll have a conceptual knowledge, but they're not going to have a practice knowledge. They won't have any experiential knowledge because they've never sat on a cushion for any extended period of time. And I said, well, I'm not so sure that that's true. I can tell you they haven't had the same type of experience that you get, exactly the same experience you get from sitting on a cushion. But I can also tell you that I have seen meditation experiences happening with children and with teachers in the room kind of spontaneously by doing these relatively simple and dopey but fun kids' practices that some adults have a hard time accessing on the cushion. This is really exciting from the perspective of people who teach mindfulness to adults. Because what it means is that there's a whole group of people who come to adult teachers hoping to have some mindfulness experience where they have a deep sense of this joy I'm talking about, or this peace, or this steadiness, and they can't get to it because there's a lot of thinking getting in the way. And what we're learning in the kids' arena is by getting them in there just doing these dopey things with children, some of these experiences emerge. Very exciting. We're going to see, I think, over the course of the next 12 years, a lot of that knowledge starting to show up in adult training in different places. So we've got the co-teaching, we've got the co-learning, we've got are two other questions that are really important here. One is, and this is a big question showing up in different places, is meditation essential to mindfulness? How many of you have heard this question? Yeah, I mean, it's really starting to show up. There's people saying, well, meditation isn't necessarily essential to mindfulness. And I think one of the reasons it, and as we know from what Diana was teaching today, and unfortunately I wasn't here to be able to reference other people's teachings from a couple days ago, meditation isn't per se necessary to have a mindful experience. But I can say from a classical perspective, meditation as a component of mindfulness training is necessary. If we're doing a practice, that a training that's consistent with a classical practice. But what is meditation when you're talking with children? Is it sitting on a cushion for 20 minutes? Or is it short time, many times, to borrow from Mincha Rinpoche, short time, many times, dropped in over a period of time? Is it that 30 seconds with the bell? Is it the 30 seconds standing in line, waiting before going out for recess, where we move our attention from what we're thinking about to the sensations on the bottom of our feet, just what Diana had us do today? How do we drop the practice Diana gave us today into what we're already doing? If you're in the classroom, you add it at the lunch line, you add it at the fire drill, you add it any time children are waiting. We're just waiting with awareness. So from my perspective, meditation is a necessary component of mindfulness training. Not everybody agrees with me, but I do believe one of the reasons that this is becoming an open question is because of this sense that mindfulness is being so broadly defined. It's being defined as art and music and dance and yoga and all sorts of things that do have qualities of mindfulness. I love that these things are coming together. These things all benefit children. There's tremendous overlap in what they're teaching. But going back to what the premise of my talk here was, is that if we are identifying specific aspects of mindfulness that are unique, that are different from what's already there and already of service to the children, then what are the unique components? And if you're looking back at classical tradition, in my humble opinion, and I can tell you there are people who I have great respect for who disagree with me, meditation is a necessary component of mindfulness training, at least with respect to adults and for children in this short time, many times. But as I said, this is my opinion. There's people who I have high regard for who couldn't disagree with me more on that. Now, the other piece that is really interesting here is this question of how much training is enough. Is a one-day program teaching mindful skills enough training to go in and teach kids? Or do you need to come to something like this? Or do you need to have a year-long program? I mean, there's a lot of great, great training programs coming out, and they're using very, very different models. And what I'm going to say to you may be surprising to some, but I think the question, especially when we're talking about busy teachers, on how much training is enough, is it's a little bit like the answer my daughter gives me when we talk about dieting. It's what you'll do. What is the best diet for you if you're trying to lose weight? It's the diet you follow. That's the best diet for you. What's the best training in mindfulness? It's the one that you'll actually go to and take and complete. So what that means is that many, many people come into this with a one-day training. So what do? Do we say, okay, now you can't go out and practice with kids? You have to wait until you do these other things? Well, I actually do say to some people, you can't go out. And the people I say in my own personal mind, it's not wise to go out and teach people who are not already working with children. But if you're already working with children, finding ways to integrate this into what you're already doing, since you already have good classroom management skills, you already have group facilitation skills, you already have a developmental understanding, yeah, you go in, you start, and this wonderful cycle of co-teaching and co-learning goes on. Now, that said, the type of training that I do with teachers is a much, much longer process, and it's a much, much longer than one day, and it spans at least 6 months, and it requires much more practice and much more training. But I will also say that there are a number of teachers who come to my training who would never have come if they hadn't started someplace. So we have to start someplace. Again, I can tell you that there probably are people who disagree with me on that, too. Now, one of the other things we're seeing on the teacher training piece, and one of the reasons that I am focused so much on training teachers and integrating into what you're already doing, rather than throwing that baby out with the bathwater and say, okay, I know we paid for this great life skills program, and I know we've all been trained in it, but now mindfulness is popular, so let's get rid of that, and now let's bring in the mindfulness program. Instead of this dualistic way of looking at things, the idea that I propose is that we try to integrate mindfulness into what you're already doing. There's another reason why I think it's important that we integrate mindfulness into what we're already doing, and possibly a more profound reason than the first one that I just mentioned. And that is the importance of mindfulness coming in through the culture itself. Now, I tell a story about how somebody made fun of me and a couple of other people because we were a bunch of white, middle-class, middle-aged women going in to underserved areas. And I must tell you, the only one of those that got on my nerve was the middle-aged part, because all the rest of it, well, it's all right, but still, you know, I didn't want to be reminded of the middle-aged thing at that point. But there's truth to that. There's truth to that. And we have to listen to that, and we have to pay attention to it. And how do we get around that? How we get around that is by going into the culture the school culture. I don't just mean in the United States. I've taught in other countries as well. I've taught in private school cultures. They're very different from public school cultures. I've taught in private school cultures that are very different from each other. So there's all kinds of diversity. Doesn't matter what the diversity is. What the mindfulness program that works is the one that stays, the one that takes hold, is the one where you can go in with enough confidence in your program, enough confidence in how to teach it, that you can help your group adapt it to what they already have. Teachers are exhausted. Schools are broke. Administrators are exhausted. Administrators don't want to be asking their busy teachers to do something else. So if mindfulness is another add-on that's going to be stressful, first of all, it's kind of silly, given what we're teaching, that we're adding stress to these already stressed out teachers. And second of all, what's the likelihood of this being sustainable? Not high. It'll stay while you've got that program in place, but afterwards it's going to peter away. However, if you're able to go in, talk to the school, talk to the organization, talk to the youth services organization. What are you already doing? How can we integrate mindfulness into what you're already doing? Can we integrate it into your council practice? Can we integrate it into your morning meeting? Can we integrate it into the... I remember Diana did a program years ago where it went over the school bell, remember? And we all thought it was kind of silly, but the joke is it worked. You know, where can we integrate what we are doing into what the culture is already doing so that it can start slowly, surely, gain hold, and go? So when we talk about diversity, we really are talking about the need to be extremely humble, extremely confident in our knowledge of the practice, extremely confident in our knowledge of what works, extremely humble in our knowledge of how to apply it to this particular environment. And then go in, dropping our ego, which Diana was talking about today, dropping this sense of it's my way or the highway, and working with the people who are already there to determine how to integrate mindfulness in the way that's most likely to be sustainable and acceptable to the community in which you're teaching. So those are the things, those are the highlights or the caveats around attention training. The second piece, remember, is we're talking about motivation. We said there's three different areas that, in my humble opinion, are what separates out mindfulness training from other wonderful, strong interventions programs that are already there and already working. The first was very specific methodologies in training of attention. And then the questions really are, now how do we get teachers trained in that? Because it takes a long time to learn that stuff. And what's the best way to do it? The second, remember, is the motivation for training attention. The motivation for training attention, from the classical perspective, is to develop a way of being in the world. Right? So here comes the B word. The Buddhism word, a word that I was quite worried about using many, many years ago, and a word which I am very careful using in a secular context now. But I will say, and this may be coming from my old law training, I was supposed to give a talk on this at Buddhist Geeks, but unfortunately I had to cancel because of these health problems. But the talk that I was giving at Buddhist Geeks was, don't let Buddhism be the elephant in the room. And I say that because I think we are at a point now with the popularization of mindfulness and the acceptance of mindfulness is that it is wise to acknowledge that these practices have roots in classical training from the Buddhist tradition. We have lots and lots of research, especially research coming out of laboratories like Richie Davidson's in Madison or Amishi Jha in Florida. And this research is for adults, but it is using Buddhist techniques to show measurable changes in behavior and to the brain and to the nervous system. And we can use that to justify, to explain, to contextualize why we can take these practices that were developed in a Buddhist context, that were not developed in a secular context, and apply them in a secular context. We also have 30 years of MBSR, which is known around the world. John is still killing himself out there working and talking and really raising awareness. And MBSR is unabashedly based on Buddhist practices too, yet it's a completely secular program. So we don't need to be afraid of Buddhism, the word Buddhism, in the way that we used to be. And I'd really encourage you to think about that, because I see a lot of fear out there, and I just don't think it's necessary. And I do think, and I have seen problems where we pretend it's not there, and then it just seems like we're trying to hide something, or people don't believe it, and it creates a sense of a lack of trust and confidence. It's okay that these practices, these attention training practices, were developed in a classical Buddhist tradition. It is possible to take out the active ingredients of those, and we actually better know the active ingredients of those from adult research than we do from children's research. It is possible to take out those active ingredients and integrate them into our secular work. So, yes, by talking about meditation, the motivation for attention training being to create a different way of being in the world, it does again raise this issue of Buddhism, possibly. I don't think we need to be afraid of that. The other thing that's really important to remember is something that is a Tibetan proverb that I heard from Joseph Goldstein, who is a teacher in the same tradition Jack Kornfeld is, who started this. He is out on the East Coast at IMS. And it is, all of mindfulness rests on the tip of motivation. All of mindfulness rests on the tip of motivation. So when we think, why are we training attention? This is an important question when we're talking about practicing mindfulness. Because if we're training attention to create nice little robotic kids who do well at standardized test scores, there's nothing wrong with this. Kids need to do well on standardized tests. Attention training will help them do that. But the question is it mindfulness? Is it mindfulness based on the classical training? So all of motivation, all of mindfulness rests on motivation. Thus, it's important to ask yourself, why are you teaching mindfulness to your kids? And I'm not, it doesn't have to be either or. I remember I started this because in 1998-ish, because I wanted to help my son with attention. He was the nicest kid in the world. I wasn't worried about his kindness and compassion. I was worried about his attention, and I wanted these practices to help with that. It was interesting because as a result, there was, in the way that I was practicing with him, now in retrospect, 12 years later, 10, whatever it is, I see that there was an imbalance in it. But I was drawn to it because I wanted to help with attention. So there's not a judgment here. All I'm saying is that, remember what Diana was saying today, mindfulness, you just want to be aware of where that arm is. We just want to be aware of where our motivation is. Diana was aware when she dropped that diaper into the diaper bin. We want to be aware of our motivation. It's not bad, it's good. It doesn't have to be those two hands. We can open our hands, just build awareness around it, build some space around it. So the third is, so what is this way of being in the world that we're talking about? Remember, we had three things. The first one that is unique is that mindfulness has a very specific methodology for training attention. Two, it has a very specific motivation for training attention. Three, the motivation is a way of being in the world. What is that way of being in the world? Well, there's lots and lots of different answers to that question. One of the ways of being in the world is exactly what Diana was teaching today, which was the presencing. And what is that presencing? It is a steadiness, it's a groundedness, it's a non-reactivity. But it's more than that. What we do first, and this is also why mindfulness practices are uniquely suited for children, uniquely suited for children, and again, we are learning and teaching mindfulness to children that we teach them in a little bit different order than we teach them to adults. They're uniquely suited for children because they ground them. They ground them. They help them with emotional regulation. How do they do that? They do it with practices that you've been learning, as I understand it, over the last couple of days, moving your attention away from what you're thinking about to a sensory experience. This has a grounding effect. It has a way of steadying. When you are steady, you're then able to look at what's happening around you and make choices that are in your own best interest and the best interests of others around you. So the first way of being in the world that mindfulness teaches is a steady, less reactive way of being in the world that we learn to be through learning some of these very specific category of attention training practices that we talked about in number one. Another way we steady ourselves in mindfulness is a less experiential in the first instance, a less physical in the first instance way. Remember, the physical way is moving your attention from what you're thinking about to a sensory experience, the feeling of breathing, for example, to a more of a thinking way, which is shifting your attention to the present moment. Now, we can get a little bit more refined, and you were doing that today, shifting present a physical experience in the present moment. But you can also just start by not allowing your mind to be worrying about the past or planning in the future and just bringing your mind back to now. Bringing your mind back to now. Two ways that mindful attention training practices help develop a way of being in this world that is steady, that is grounded. What happens when we're steady and grounded? When we're steady and grounded, we can see what's happening into and around us more clearly. And what happens when we can see what's happening clearly? We start remembering things. Remember mindfulness, the definition to take heed to remember. We start remembering things. What's the first thing we remember? We remember to take care of ourselves. Remember to take care of ourselves. I had what I found to be quite interesting, somewhat upsetting conversation recently. I had been hearing for quite some time about a young new mindfulness teacher on the scene who everybody loved. Everybody thought she was fantastic. And one thing led to another, and we had a phone call. Now, I'm quite accustomed to us old bags up here, you know, not Diana, she's younger than we are, but, you know, and Kate's younger than, but I'm quite accustomed to those of us who have been on the scene for a long time being absolutely exhausted. I'm quite accustomed to all of us being completely and totally burnt out. I'm quite accustomed to all of us being teaching balance, but being completely out of balance. But when I talked to this young mindfulness teacher and heard that she was exhausted, that she was out of balance, that she was burning the candle from both ends, that she was getting pressure from all sides, it really made me sad. It really made me sad. And it reminded me of why we're doing all this. It reminded me of this way of being in the world. And it reminded me of my favorite teaching in all of classical training. And it is, I think, the best teaching that I know of for caregivers, for parents, for mental health workers, for teachers. It's taking care of yourself, you take care of others. Taking care of others, you take care of yourself. Taking care of yourself, you take care of others. Taking care of others, you take care of yourself. This is something we all forget. And I will say that as a professional in this field, I view it as a big problem. The need is so great. This field draws caregivers. The excitement is so great that people are just getting completely fried. And I just don't see how this is sustainable when people are working so hard. I also know from personal experience it's a tremendous, tremendous barrier to creativity. And it's a tremendous, tremendous barrier to joy. So unfortunately, I had to cancel a whole bunch of stuff this summer because of this thing, which there's nothing to worry about. So I'm not trying to worry anybody. But I do have a couple things I have to deal with. So unfortunately, as a result, I had to cancel a whole bunch of stuff. And I'd planned on planting a garden, but because I was going to be home more, I planted a bigger garden. Which might be half my problem, you know, but anyway. So in doing that, I started getting a bunch of zucchini, and there were more berries around and everything. And so I started baking pies, but because they were one crust pies rather than two crust pies, I had two crusts because I buy the frozen crusts. I will admit that to you. And so the first time I thought, well, you know, a friend of my kids, remember my children now are 18 and 21, had just had some back surgery. She was a dancer and she had to have back surgery at 18. So I made a pie. My family could really only eat one pie. So I said, bring the second pie over to Brookie. I had the kids bring it over. They brought it over. And they came back and we just had the most interesting conversation about everybody was surprised. They couldn't believe there was a pie, whatever. A couple days later, I had a whole bunch of zucchini. If you guys buy these frozen pie crusts, they come in packages of two. You can't just buy one. I had two of them. I made a second zucchini. I put a sign on it. Now remember, I don't have little kids anymore. I wish I had thought of this when I had little kids. I put random act of kindness on it. So I made the second zucchini. I said, just take it. Take it to somebody who you think you want to give a quiche to. Well, I've baked a bunch of pies since then and quiche and everything. And it has been a fascinating, fascinating experience in my family because we have these conversations now. Well, who are we going to give this stuff to? But I never, except for that first one pie I made for Brookie, I never decide who I'm going to make that pie for. I just make the second one because I'm making them already for our family. And then the process emerges, where does the pie or the quiche go? I could never possibly have come up with that had I not gotten sick and had to cancel all this stuff. And it's not that it takes so long to make that pie. It doesn't take long at all. It's exactly the same amount as making, one pie. You just make the filling twice and put it in the frozen crust. It's because I was so exhausted. I was so out of balance. Diana was talking about this today in another context. My mind was like this. I was so gripped because of exhaustion of trying to do, that I didn't have the spaciousness and I didn't have the relaxation that you need to be creative, to have this kind of joy in your life, to have it not a big deal to just make a second pie. But what happened when life just gave me these lemons is I was able to turn it into lemonade because by relaxing, by taking the time off, by getting some rest, by being around the house more, some ideas started to open up. Some space started opening up. I was able to be less constricted around this. Now, this is really important from the perspective of mindfulness. Because one of the things we're seeing in this world of mindfulness and what can mindfulness offer that is unique and that is different is we can do this differently, guys. We can create a field that is different than the ones that are out there. And we can create a field where we have less of a sense of separation. We can create a field where we all float each other's boats. We can create a field where we are kind and we're compassionate to each other. And we can do that by following the simple mindfulness teaching of what is compassionate action. Very, very simple, very, very definition, very, very simple, clear definition for compassionate action. Compassionate action is action where you concentrate on the goodness of what you're doing, on the goodness of the quality of effort and not on results. Now, I have a mortgage to pay too. I've got two kids going to college. We all have to make a living. We all have worked hard. We want our programs to be meaningful. There are a lot of ego things that we just can't pretend that aren't there. But what I will propose to you guys is that as a field, if we remind ourselves of these key universal concepts, like less dualistic thinking, hands open rather than closed, like compassionate action, like motivation, what's my motivation for doing this? Like no separation. Interdependence, one of the ways interdependence is defined in the Buddhist tradition is as relationship. We are all in relationship with one another. By reminding ourselves of these key universal concepts over and over and over again, we can create a field where the quality is different. So I'm going to close with my last story. And my last story is in this kind of odd summer I'm having. I was hiking with some women who I know, but I don't know that well. And one of them had a middle school girl, and I had a middle school daughter once. She's now in college. And middle school girls tend not to be very nice. And she was telling these stories about this horrible experience. And it was all moms, and we were commiserating with her. And then one of the women, who I know pretty well, but I guess I didn't know that well, said, "Wow, what is it about us women? Why is it we women?" Now, she wasn't talking about the middle school girls anymore. "Why is it we women aren't very kind to each other? What's that about? You know, we all say we're friends, but we're not very kind to each other." And I thought, I don't know who you're hanging out with, but that's not consistent with my experience. Well, that was one of those, I didn't say that out loud, thank goodness, because that was one of those comments that has stayed with me this summer when I've had a lot more space, where I've had a lot more, less constriction because I had to slow down. And I think there's truth to it. So there was a, and I think there's truth to it, not just for women, but in the mindfulness community. Sometimes we aren't that kind to each other. So there was a television show about 30 years ago. Some of you may be old enough to remember. It was called Hill Street Blues. And Hill Street Blues started with a cop talking to his cops, and he always ended with, "Be careful out there." And when I was first training teachers, which has to be 10 years ago, now at that point they weren't school teachers, they were teachers, meditators to teach kids, I would say to them, "Be careful out there," at the end, Joe making this Hill Street Blues reference, because I was worried about the word Buddhism and the Buddhist. Now we know, because I've told you, I'm not so worried about that anymore. So I'm not telling people to be careful out there anymore. But what I would say is, let's be kind out there. Let's be kind out there. Let's model for our students what we're asking them to be. Let's be open-handed. Let's be open-minded. Let's remember there's no separation. Let's remember taking care of ourselves, we take care of others. And taking care of others, we take care of ourselves. And if we do that, one of the things we know from classical training is something emerges. And that thing that emerges is that three-letter word I started with, is joy. So, that's it. So thank you. So I think we're going to do some walking meditation. Has anyone instructed any? Okay.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.